Today is the, January 2023. I'm Lacey Wilson, public historian of the Albany African American History Project, and I'm here with Jamella Anderson, goes by they, them pronouns, and I go by she, her, intending to do an oral interview talking about their nonprofit work, their work in protests in the Capital District and the Capital Region, as well as the clothes that they create and the art coming from that. So, want to start again by thanking you for agreeing to do this.
Yeah, I'm really excited. I feel very lucky to be able to do this with you. So
thank you so much.
Excited.
So we'll start at the beginning. Where were you born?
I was born in Clifton Park, which is, for those maybe listening that are not familiar, is it okay to like talk like that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I was born in Clifton Park, and that is just like a suburb of Albany. It's about 20 minutes north if you're not from the area. Some people don't even really know about Clifton Park.
Sure.
I live in Albany sometimes. I remember as a kid people didn't know where it was. But I spent a lot of time back and forth between Clifton Park and Albany. So although I didn't like necessarily live here until I was 18, I did like spend a lot of weekends here. I have my father's side of the family, which my mother was really close with. We spent a lot of time with them, and so Albany has always been not even a second home, but just like another home for me.
Yeah, an additional home in that sense. Because I feel like when I was reading up about you, I remember what neighborhood was it that your father's family was from? I don't remember now. Where was it? Where did you spend a lot of time in Albany growing up?
I think it was Arbor Hill. They moved, like, the specific part of the family that I was really spent close time with was Arbor Hill, and I don't know if it was called West Hill back in the day, but I think West Hill as well, but like predominantly Arbor Hill. And so yeah, it's definitely like interesting now as an adult to like see the neighbor, like to see it from different eyes. Because like when I was younger, it just always felt like fun and cheery and happy, and like now, because of like the way the city has gone, it's like really been sort of neglected. So it's really weird. I'm like, was it always like that? Or is it am I more aware? It's like one of those things. So that's like where I spent a lot of time.
That was going to be my next question, because like some of those neighborhoods are so predominantly Black, just the way that like Albany was like set up and grew over time, that I was wondering if there were like any specific changes that you remember noticing as you got older, just as you became more aware, anything sort of stick out to you in terms of that?
Honestly, I would say like the livelihood, maybe not livelihood is the right word, but like the like life. Like, I feel like when I was a kid, Albany felt way more communal, and I felt like maybe it was because of social media, and maybe the internet, and like all those things like obviously play a huge factor, and like video games and like kids being outside more, like and we were outside, you know. Mom, can I stay out? And like, yeah, when the street lights turn on, come back in. You know, that type of thing. Can I stay over 30 more minutes? Like, even in Clifton Park, in my little neighborhood that I lived in, like, it was the same thing. So I think like that to me is honestly one of the biggest things. It's like, so it doesn't feel that there's as big of a community, like people outside and like hanging out, kids playing in the street, kids at the park. Like, I remember just going to the park and, you know, hanging out with kids all the time that I didn't know, that I'll never see again, you know. Washington Park, the playground when it was more of a death trap. Now it's like a lot safer. I feel sort of lucky to have
had that version
that was like a little scary. But it definitely, like, my dad and I spent a lot of time at that park together, and just like going there, and like my dad and I are very close, and he just like, we would always be together. People would always see us out. And I just remember as a kid going to the museum, New York State Museum, and then going to Washington Park, and like even just walking around the plaza. So like all of those places are like very nostalgic for me, and so being able to be here and have such vivid, clear memories of those, it really like makes Albany seem brighter for me, especially as I remember it as a kid. So
yeah.
I think like ultimately that's sort of what it is. Like, it just, again, I don't know if it was like rose-colored glasses because of being a kid, or if it really was like that, but either way, that's like sort of how I remember it. And so definitely trying to keep that going, and like trying to let those memories sort of like come to fruition now as an adult, and like recreating memories and happiness and just like thinking about the plaza and when it's sunny mm-hmm. and going to Black Fest or going to anything going on and having like all these really big musicians play mm-hmm. and like I just have those fond memories.
Yeah.
Does it seem like that all the time now? I think it's definitely shifted. But that's something that I really like has been memorialized in my brain.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And so you were, you grew up in Albany, in essentially Clifton Park, but essentially Albany.
Yeah. Like our weekends and stuff, we would be down here,
yeah.
With my family. Yeah,
for sure. I feel, let me know if I'm incorrect remembering this. I remember in reading up about you that you had struggled, your family had struggled with food insecurity before you'd even gotten into where you are now
yeah.
at this point. So what
yeah.
did that look like?
So I, one of the things that people think of when they think of Clifton Park, for those who know it,
mm-hmm.
is that it's like Saratoga Junior. So
mm-hmm.
there's like a lot of money. It's
mm-hmm.
predominantly white.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who are of color there also have money, you know, like, so it's like really like the narrative is definitely different than
mm-hmm.
like what I know is reality now. And so it was like an interesting thing. So like my grandparents, they weren't like rich or anything, but
sure.
they had money. So my mom she was a single mother in theory.
Mm-hmm.
Like I lived with her. My parents weren't together most of my life.
Mm-hmm.
So she struggled a lot
mm-hmm.
and my grandparents were always there to help. So it was like, I got this, like I could go to my grandparents and be like, I need something and they could get it for me.
Mm-hmm.
Or my mom couldn't provide,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it was like light shut off
mm-hmm.
and I go stay with my grandparents, or my mom had depression or has had depression her whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And so like that really played into it too. And so it's sort of like one of those things where whenever there was like another person in the house, whether it was like a friend staying with us or a boyfriend or whatever,
mm-hmm.
that's when she would like cook and be like happy and on. And
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't like that. It was like there was no food in the house. Like beginning of the month, we had a bunch of food. By the end of the month, like there was no food in the house. I don't like eating certain foods still because it reminds me of that time.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're a kid, it's just sort of like in my brain, like, that was just what was reality. It was, you know, but I knew when I went to my grandparents' house, there'd be food in the cabinets.
Mm-hmm.
But when I went home, it was like, sometimes I'm eating grits out of a packet or oatmeal out of a packet. And
mm-hmm.
like, there's nothing wrong with that, but like, I need something else. Like I need my parent to cook for me,
yeah.
you know, but it was like, okay, well we didn't have money for food.
Yeah.
And also she was going through it, you
yeah.
know? And so I had an interview yesterday, actually, that I said the same thing. It was just like, really like, you don't get how bad things are until
mm-hmm.
you're older and you reflect on
mm-hmm.
like scarcity and like what that means and like how it like really writes your personality for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to like constantly and consistently undo that
yeah.
throughout your life. So I did struggle with food insecurity and the resources were not as, although there's like a lot of resources in Albany,
mm-hmm.
And sometimes they're difficult to get to.
Mm-hmm.
Clifton Park has even less, you know, and it's also like the stigma attached to it.
Yeah.
You know, I once I got a little older and I recognized that we were like didn't have money, or that like all my friends had big houses and we lived in a small apartment
mm-hmm.
or whatever the case, which there's absolutely nothing wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
But like as a child, you don't really understand what that means.
Yeah.
And friends always came over my house. Like nobody was ever upset. Like no, everyone always came over and it was fine. And we all hung out and like, it was cool, and like that was one of my favorite things to do was have people over. But just to really notice those differences, and as you get older, you need more money, and
mm-hmm.
everyone's starting to go to college,
yeah.
and you know, and then you recognize you're like, oh, like I don't have a choice.
Yeah,
I can sort of do what is within reach,
mm-hmm.
and what does that even mean?
Yeah, what resources do you remember being available in addition to the network that you had of your grandparents being
yeah.
able to have that because that's so crucial for so many
yeah.
people. Being able to, like, at least there's a backup in terms of someone else being able to take care of you for a couple of days or a couple of nights
mm-hmm.
that you're going to continue to grow and be alive and stuff. But what resources do you remember being available at the time that would have been hard, that were within reach or were not within reach?
So one of the things was the quarter lunch,
mm-hmm.
Which I didn't utilize that often. Like we had to sign up for it. And basically you go into school, you get a quarter lunch
mm-hmm.
and which is like, I don't know, you can tie that back to Black Panther roots for like free lunch and all that, you know, like,
sure.
so it was like adopted into school and I saw the other kids who were like using it, you know? And I was like, I'm not those kids. I'm I have new clothes. I have shoes, you know, like
yeah.
those things like
mm-hmm.
that I had to like tell myself. We're like, I'm not them. I'm like, as if I'm better. And I'm like, I'm so sad that I had that thought in my brain, you know, like I feel so sad that I even had to compare myself or that anybody was comparing, because like, I just need to survive and exist and like, you know, go to school, 'cause I'm just a kid, you know, but it's like that constant comparing. And like, especially I was, again, yesterday I was in a, talking about the early 2000s and how like we're really children of like social media and we're really children of TV, and like all the things you see on TV are directly reflected onto us, and we really like soak that in. And then it was like, so all of these like stigmas attached to that really like affected me. And so like I only had my parents sign up for it like once or twice, and then, you know, I would either not eat lunch or a friend would buy me lunch, because we had the kids who had like, you know, hundreds of dollars on their lunch tabs. And so there was that, and then there was a program called Captain, which, you know, 20 years later, I ended up, I got awarded a grant yesterday, and they were one of the people who also got awarded a grant, and we were in a fellowship together, like this, the executive director of that program, and myself, and a few other people, were all in this fellowship together, and it was really wild, because here I am sitting next to this person who, like, runs this organization that directly helped me.
Literally fed you.
Yeah, and so that, to me, is, like, when I look at where I've come, and I look at my story, like, it's like, wow, like, you just really never know, like, how things turn out or end up or whatever. So that specifically was like a moment of like, wow, I'm really grateful that this program exists, and I'm really grateful that it still exists. And it was right across the street from where we lived, like one of the like satellite locations, and so we used it, and so that was one thing. But again, what was that?
What is Captain?
So Captain is, I actually don't know all the services that they provide, but they do help. It's like a food, like a small food pantry, and I think they provide like after school services, and like they offer like intervention services. And so I lived in an apartment complex across the street from a trailer park, and in the trailer park was the satellite Captain place. And so that was also like another thing, like you have to go into the trailer park, which was like not due to the people there, but like another area that was like underserved and like under resourced. There's no, you know, not a grocery store within walking distance. Not everybody in the trailer park has a car. We didn't have like, you only have taxi service as a form of transportation if you don't have your own vehicle. And so to me, which I'm sure we'll get into later, like what poor looked like to me was that. And so like, I didn't reflect that. I didn't look like anybody who lived in the trailer park. There were no black people in there. And so like, as I got older and people would like have this negative connotation about Albany being like poor and then synonymous with black, which like is completely wrong. It really was like confusing to me. And I'm like, I don't get it. I'm like, what are you talking? Because when I go to Albany, I have all these beautiful, happy thoughts. When I'm in Clifton Park, I'm sad. I have lots of trauma that I experience, you know? And so it was always just like a weird thing that was always kind of at play. And then like, sorry, I'm going off on a tangent, as I always do.
This is good.
And I'm biracial, so like, that there's always like this constant like, am I this enough? Am I that enough? I'm not enough, you know? And so like, even having those differences within Clifton Park and Albany, it was like, there was like that very clear like divide of like who I am, where I feel comfortable, where I don't feel comfortable, do I fit in, whatever. So anyway, so Captain was in the trailer park, and you know, we did have like those church groups that would drop off baskets of food, and like, being able, the past 3 years, we've like dropped off meals and turkeys and all that into the fridges, and it has been, I get so like in it, I don't think about it, and then when I pan out, I'm like, oh my gosh, like, I'm literally doing what I was the recipient of, you know, and like, I don't need a pat on the back at all for that, but I'm just like, wow, like, you really don't recognize how much your upbringing affects you as an adult, and what you do in the future. Whether it's to distance yourself from it or to like turn around and say, okay, well, how can I provide even just a couple people with something? And it, again, it's never for credit or anything. I don't care if nobody knows who I am. Like, I just want people to be able to eat and know that they have a reliable source to eat. Because again, I grew up in an area where like there weren't those resources. I couldn't just go down the street and go to the store. We had like a little, like a corner store. But there was like, you can't really get anything there. It's like
not nearly any produce for sure.
Absolutely not. It's right. All box frozen. Sitting on the, not even frozen. Just literally box. Just box, because it was literally a trailer, mm-hmm. outside of the trailer park.
Yeah.
That just had like box stuff and penny candy. Mm-hmm. And that was like on our road, and then on that same road was a trailer park, two apartment complexes, and $1 million homes, mm-hmm. which is like the wildest thing to, yeah. like go down the street and like hit all of those like demographics.
Yeah.
And like to see that really, like, you need to have money to live in that area. Yeah. Even if you live in a place that might be more economically easier and financially, it's like there still are not resources around you to be able to use. And so I wouldn't say that Clifton Park is a food desert by any means, or experiencing a food apartheid. But I do think that there are limitations and restrictions on what is available to people, unless you have all of the amenities that, you know, the house and the car and the picket fence and the, you know, they really make it like very, very like apparent that if you don't have all that, you can't get everything you need.
Yeah. So those are resources that you use. Do you remember any resources that there were attempts to use that you were unable to, or things that you found out later on that might have been useful at the time?
Honestly, specifically in Clifton Park, I don't know. I think that there are a lot more programs within our schools, mm-hmm. that I could have accessed. And like, whether it be after school programs or tutors, or like reaching out to the school to say, oh, we don't have money for this, can you help?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that specifically, like, I tried to like distance myself from that, mm-hmm. because I felt the stigma against it. And I'm like, I'm already like one of the only black people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to be like, I don't want to look a certain way or people say a certain thing because I'm black. And I'm so sad that I had those thoughts,
mm-hmm.
but it's just the reality of growing up where you grow up, when, sure. you're not reflected in anything.
Yeah.
You know, or the, it's not common knowledge that there are these resources or that people are using them, mm-hmm. you know, and it shouldn't be, I don't think it should be such a secret. You know, I think that there should be more, like, I shouldn't have to relay to my parents what's available.
Right.
My parents should know what's available. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why that was. I don't know if it was because of them, or they were working or busy or didn't care. And I really don't think that they didn't care.
Right.
But, so I think that that's sort of like that missing piece is like, I didn't know what was available. You,
right.
don't know what you don't know.
For sure.
And that comes up kind of a lot in my life as a kid. You don't know what you don't know.
Yeah. So if we switch over a little bit, like, where I feel like when we think about people who are activists and working in the communities, there's so many different ways to start,
mm-hmm.
in that kind of work. What would you define as your start on, like, community-focused work?
Like community advocacy?
Sure.
Yeah. I think that I have always done it. Whether it was silenced or not, because it was mostly silenced when I was younger,
mm-hmm.
even just like in my early 20s, mm-hmm. I feel like I was silenced a lot when I spoke up about what was going on and like how things affected me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was gaslit every step of the way,
mm-hmm.
Especially with my peers, you know? So I feel like it's always sort of existed. And I say, you know, as black and brown people, we are activists and abolitionists from the beginning,
mm-hmm.
from conception, you know, like that in itself, being born as an act of resistance. And the biggest thing that I think kind of propelled me into advocacy was like the pandemic, like,
mm-hmm.
you know, and some people have been like, well, you only started doing this a few years ago, like, why are you so like this? And I'm like, I didn't. You know, you just weren't listening, or you weren't in the same room as me,
mm-hmm.
or other people weren't advocating to listen to me. You know, now that other people are co-signing me, now you're listening, you know? So I think that specifically that, like, the pandemic kind of pausing the rest of the world,
mm-hmm.
and opening up even more for our world as black and brown people, queer people, like, disabled people, fat people, like queer on the spectrum, like, I feel like all of these voices started to like really up, like come up, and people were like really advocating more and sharing more. And so I think that there was an opportunity for me then to like people were like, okay, like, here's your microphone. Like, mm-hmm. here, like, the figurative and literal microphone. Mm-hmm. And I was just, like, telling stories. Mm-hmm. Telling stories of what I experienced. Raising other people, amplifying other people's voices mm-hmm. to tell their experience. And then started doing reparations work because people were like, we have resources. Like, people were really listening to me. Like, mm-hmm. we have the resource. We can get it to the people. Mm-hmm. But, like, it can't come from us. We don't want it to come from us. We, you know, like, not to say that I'm, like, need to be the face of it, but they're like, we want you to, like, have full reign over what we do. Mm-hmm. Like, or not what we do, but more of, like...
Like a facilitator kind of
thing? Yeah, like, can you help us facilitate? Which, obviously, it's like, don't pick your token black person to do all of that. But it was like, I had an opportunity to do that. Yeah. And I was like, okay, we're gonna, like... And they were like, we don't want our name on anything. We just want to give you the resource. And mm-hmm. I think that time and time again, is the way which this idea of push to steer, mm-hmm. you push... we steer is like one of the big things that has really impacted like my life. It's like you have the backing, you have the resources, whether it be white people or people of privilege with money, whatever, and like we are the ones leading. Like, we should be leading the revolution, not them, mm-hmm. because they're the ones who have always been in the driver's seat. And so just like really that approach has like really helped propel me into what I'm doing. And I don't think for a second that it was random. Like, I, you know, I've known a lot of people my whole life. I've always been like, I hate the word popular, but people have just always known me. I've worked in customer service, I've worked in the service industry, I know everybody all over the place in Albany, and it really was a privilege to be able to like have that proximity. Mm-hmm. And so when people were like, okay, like we need to change, we need to do better, so it was like easy for me to sort of switch gears into like how I started doing things. Mm-hmm. And so it was like, I'm not taking all of that for myself. I'm like, no, like, this is for all of us. And mm-hmm. so that's when all the reparations work started happening. Mm-hmm. And we raised like 20 grand in like 4 days. Mm-hmm. And we gave it to a black owned yoga studio and health center, and, you know, those stories.
Yeah. Well, that's where I wanted to dive into. Like, what did that actually look like? Like, so yeah. The pandemic hit, things are shut down. What are your first steps as you started this phase of your community work? Not yeah. to discount the stuff from before,
yeah.
but like at this particular point, what are the first steps looking like?
So I quit my job mm-hmm. in March, and that was like right before the shutdown.
Yeah.
And then I started like, honestly, like I knit. So I was like knitting things, and I was like trying to sell them, and people were like very generous. All those like community pools started opening, and mm-hmm. like people sharing money, and like my job, like, I lost all jobs. I'm also a yoga teacher and a doula, and mm-hmm. I switched to doing yoga work online, which mm-hmm. was such a bummer. but, so I was doing all that, and then, like, I was approached by this company that knows me sort of, like, just socially, mm-hmm. and they were like, we have this resource of stickers, and we would love to make, like, decals and raise money. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay. And that's like literally what happened. Okay. Like, they're like, let's raise money. And then we raise all this money. And then I started getting other community partners involved. Actually, before that, mm-hmm. I raised the African American Cultural Center got broken into, mm-hmm. or like they got like hate. There was like a hate crime of like people throwing. Yeah, like vandalization. Mm-hmm. And I got shirts printed that said Black Lives Matter on them. Just very generic, very like simple, and people donated the shirts to me, and then we got them printed, and then we raised like 5 grand immediately, like mm-hmm. within like 2 hours. I had to just like shut it down, and so that's actually what started it. It was like that. I was like, okay, like how do we step up for our community? And then after that happened, someone had approached me about stickers and the decals, which are still all over the place. mm-hmm. And so then I was like, okay, like we can do this, like mm-hmm. we can like people were reaching out to me left and right, like we have this resource, like we were doing raffles, we were doing, and so it was like really like that. And then I did a collaboration with Rosie Sunshine, who's an artist in Albany, and they are a queer artist, and they are incredible. So we did a collaboration with them, and I've raised like $500,000 I think over the past 3 years, just in like mutual aid and like, you know, people donating to people and whatnot. I don't have a clear number because it just sort of gets lost in there, but mm-hmm. it's like, it's just been like that. And so it's not always about money.
Sure.
Right. And so I also was finding that there was like this performative piece to a sticker and to a shirt and to all that. And so really what I wanted to do was turn that performative into, like, actual, like, restorative action.
So what did that performative look like? How would you define that to start before you shifted over to restorative action?
So, like, I don't know, just, like, people wearing a Black Lives Matter shirt, and mm-hmm. it's, like, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Beyond that, like, people, we always, like, my friends and I always talk about the cookie. Like, mm-hmm. you always want the cookie. Mm-hmm. You went to the thing, you got the cookie, you got the award, you got the sticker.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, like, why do we have to have the badge to mm-hmm. show what we've done?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, granted, I want to keep doing that. Mm-hmm. You know, we still did more launches of shirts. We raised a lot of money through that.
Yeah.
But I'm, like, why don't we do more?
It's
like, what's something?
It's
yeah.
The next step.
Right. And so let's do this and, you mm-hmm. know? And so, like, yes, this can be performative, but does it work? It does work.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be beyond that. So when I'm, like, you know, I can only say so many times, like, do more than just wear a shirt.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, like, what is an action we can take? And so that's how the Fridge Project really came about.
Okay.
When I started getting more people talking about food justice, and I was, like, I was really interested in farming.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, like, oh, man, it would be really cool to be a farmer, especially a Black farmer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously Soul Fire Farm has, like, really done a lot with what they do, and they've been such a great, like, place
mm-hmm.
and people and network to be close to. And
mm-hmm.
I'm just really grateful for their friendship.
Mm-hmm.
And, but, you know, I was, like, I want to do something like that, but what can I do right now? Like, people are really going hungry, and we're in the pandemic, and we're in the bad part of the pandemic. Like,
mm-hmm.
we're in, like, the, we have no idea what's happening part
right.
of the pandemic,
right.
which we still don't, but it was, like, the scary, scary part.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And that specifically was, like, really when I switched gears, and people started reaching out, and they're like, well, have you heard of this type of thing? Because I didn't create free food. I didn't create the fridges themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I recreated it here and
mm-hmm.
To figure out how we could do it here.
Mm-hmm.
So we do it in, like, a little bit of a different way, where it's more of just, like, we continually put resources in. People who take from it don't need to replenish.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's sort of, like, kind of how they all have been going lately, which is great, but... sorry, I go off on so many tangents.
No, this is good.
So we just got the first fridge.
Mm-hmm.
I reached out to a bunch of places. A lot of people said no.
Mm-hmm.
And Deirdre, that used to run the free school, said yes.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first fridge went to the free school, and that was, like, sort of what wrote the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
That one yes, like, led to
mm-hmm.
so many other things
mm-hmm.
so fast. Like, I just did this thing and didn't think it was going to be, like, so big, and
sure.
then it became, like, this thing that people now rely on 3 years later.
Mm-hmm. So the process of getting that fridge, Deidre says yes, is going to go to the fridge on the free school. Where did you get the fridge?
From Lowe's. Yeah, my friend Lauren, who owns her and her husband own a place on Delaware, a beer shop called Delaware Supply, shameless plug. And they, Lauren knew a person named Joel that worked at Lowe's.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was just, like, a series of yeses. And
okay.
and I was like, okay. And then I reached out to Honest Way Food Co-op.
Mm-hmm.
And Alex Mitelka, who his last day was yesterday there.
Mm-hmm.
He had been there for 10 years. But he, like, had been watching what I was doing online and stuff. And was, like, really inspired and really wanted to partner. So, like, they've been my partner, like, from the start, you know. And so, like, that specifically, it's, like, how do we leverage reparations and, like feeding the community, like, figuratively and literally feeding the community. And so, like, that's what it was. I was like, this is a call to action to everyone. Y'all bought a shirt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's buy food. And, like, let's not stop buying food.
Mm-hmm.
Let's keep going and
mm-hmm.
let's keep feeding and, like, let's paint them. They're mini murals. Like, let's make them attractive for children. Like,
mm-hmm.
let's put this on the community as, like, let's give ownership back. Like,
mm-hmm.
although it's a small little thing,
mm-hmm.
if we can give ownership back to the people,
mm-hmm.
which is what they need and deserve, then, like, what can that do? What can that do for little Jamella who like couldn't just walk down the street and get a free piece of food
mm-hmm.
without asking someone, you know? Like,
mm-hmm.
and so obviously there was some, like, personal aspect to it, and, like, sort of, like, healing for myself in that way, because I'm like, I'm not the only one who went through what I went through. I'm not the only one who, like, didn't have resources. I'm not the only one, like, I left it out before, but my mom, she started drinking, she started doing drugs, and so, like, by age 15, my parent was, like, non-existent,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I, like, I still have nightmares about that. Like, I had a nightmare last night about it, you know? So, like, my grandparents were there, and, like, my mom would leave for 3 and 4 days at a time. I'd have no food in the house. I'd have, like, I would find her drug stuff all over the place. Like, it was just, like, it was very bad, and it was, like, this constant, like, this is not my life, this is not my life, you know? Mm-hmm. This, like, constant state of trauma. Mm-hmm. And I'm, like, I know that I'm not the only one, and I, and again, I had grandparents there to, when I call them, like, hey, my mom hasn't come home for 3 days, you know? So I would have them there, and I know that that's not always the case, you know? Right. You don't always have family to pick you up, you know? And especially as a kid, when you're just, like, well, you know, like, what am I supposed to do? Mm-hmm. So I just, like, think of that, and I think, and I recognize that I'm not the only one, and, like, some stories are worse, some stories are not as bad, whatever the case is, wherever you fall on that timeline, it's, like, we deserve to have what we need, mm-hmm. and not to feel bad or shame or stigmatized for asking for it or wanting it or mm-hmm. needing it or getting it. Mm-hmm. And so, like, how do we, like, lift that stigma, mm-hmm. and how do we rewrite the narrative on what it means to be supported by your community? Mm-hmm. And it may be something small, but there should be a bunch of small and big things that work together to support each other. And, like, that's what, that specifically is why mutual aid is so important. Mm-hmm. It's because, like, we all have some abundance of some sort, whether it's love or a hug or a shirt that you don't wear anymore or a pair of shoes that you don't wear anymore, or, you know, like, everyone's got something, and sometimes there are people who really don't have anything to give, mm-hmm. and it's like, okay, well, how do we uplift them, mm-hmm. so that one day that they're in the position that we're in, that we're able to give back, or maybe they choose to stay where they are and they deserve resources no matter what, mm-hmm. you know, like, it doesn't, just because someone might not live in a house doesn't mean that they're undeserving of basic necessities, mm-hmm. you know. And again, to go back to scarcity mindset, like, mm-hmm. that really writes personalities, and that writes intergenerational trauma. Mm-hmm. It's like that mindset, you know, and, like, especially for Black and Brown people, post-traumatic slave disorder is, like, that's, like, so many things that play into that. Mm-hmm. And to hear people say that, like, you know, well, I don't own slaves, or I don't own this, or I don't, you know, and it's like, when you hear that from white people, and you're like, are you serious? Like, you really have so much, and, like, I have so much learning to still do. I have so much unlearning to still do. We all do. But I'm like, to hear those things, it's so harmful, mm-hmm. because it just, like, people don't believe in racism. People don't believe in how bad it is, or reparations, or whatever. And I'm just like, why? You know, like, all these things are real. Mm-hmm. Like, there's trauma. Mm-hmm. We all carry trauma. Mm-hmm. And how do we undo that? And it's by helping each other, you know, supporting each other, recognizing that you can help someone. When I hear someone, I don't have anything, or I don't have money, or people are, I'm like, walk someone across the street, you know, like, make sure when you see a kid without gloves, you know, I always tell people to keep gloves in your glove box, or a couple dollars a week in your glove box. So when you're going down the street and someone's, like, asking for money, you can give it to them, you know? And it's like, who cares what they use it for? You know, you have a good intention to give it to them, and, like, hopefully they use it for what they need. And sometimes that might be something you may not think is necessary. Mm-hmm. And, like, that's not your place to judge, mm-hmm. you know? And so I think that all of those things are important as a society. And, like, people have helped me so much in my life that, like, any bit that we can do for each other is important.
Mm-hmm. So when you're reflecting back on your experiences as a child struggling through a lot of this, and watching other peers in different neighborhoods and places struggle as well, and then now to be at this space where you are able to collaborate and offer assistance, when you reflect back on comparing those experiences, how did your vision of what poverty, like, expand, look like? How did your vision of food scarcity change?
As an adult?
Yeah, as an adult. Like, now if you reflect back on, like, what you experienced and what you saw, how did you see your definition of food scarcity expand?
Okay, got it. Yeah. It expanded because I saw how much waste there is, mm-hmm. right? Like, that's, like, one of the biggest things that sticks out, is that there is so much food waste, and there's so much that individuals and businesses can do. And so there's, like, I don't want to say there, like, there shouldn't be poverty. Like, there shouldn't be scarcity. Mm-hmm. There shouldn't be people and children going without things, mm-hmm. because there's so much of it, you know? And so, like, then when you start to play in systemic things, mm-hmm. you know, systemic racism, redlining that still exists, like the government, the way it's set up, even just like the way cities in particular, like, you know, government's up on the top and the housing is down at the bottom on the hill, you know, mm-hmm. You go down Morton Ave and that's literally what it is. And like, instead of a grocery store in the South End, there's a police station. Mm-hmm. And where the DMV used to be, now there's like the Board of Elections. Mm-hmm. It's like, why isn't that a grocery store? The South End Grocery was just opened this past month, and that's incredible. But it's like, it took all that time mm-hmm. to do it. And that's partly because of Price Chopper, mm-hmm. Because of their jurisdiction for like where people can build things. So it has to be independent. And so it's like, why did it take so long? Like, that McDonald's that the South End Grocery is in now, the McDonald's was there for like 20 years. I remember going there as a kid, and like that leaving is like, I'm sure it was a huge hit. So like, okay, there's no grocery store, but that type of thing where it's like, there's all these vacant lots. Mm-hmm. There's all these, like, there were houses, there were businesses, whatever. You see all these mm-hmm. pictures of Albany back in the early days, and you're like, wow, like it was bustling, mm-hmm. you know? And we used to really use the port as like a trade point, and like they don't anymore because they built 787. And so all of those things are like separation, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. us not being able to use the water like it is. And even recently, I didn't even really think about it. It's very obvious. But like Rensselaer has sort of been like sideswiped because mm-hmm. now you can't use that area mm-hmm. because there's water in between and 787 mm-hmm. and now there's like barely a way to get in and out. And so it's like there is like very direct views, and like you can see mm-hmm. the way that the city was planned and how it has like disrupted. And so like poverty was designed mm-hmm. like it was a designed thing. It wasn't a thing that just happened, you know. It doesn't happen on its own. No, it's designed that way. And like it is, you know, someone said it at a protest a few years ago, like the system is working exactly how it was designed to. And like, that is real. You know, it's not that, oh man, the systems aren't working. It's like, no, this is how they were designed. It's not about that they're not working. It's like, they were directly made the way that they are so that we could keep people from what they need. Mm-hmm. And then we can always point the finger at who's bad. Mm-hmm. And then we criminalized poverty. Mm-hmm. That's really scary.
Yeah.
Like, and then now with the moving of what, like, first of all, wages, mm-hmm. and then people, like, especially, like, families who don't have support for daycare because daycare is so expensive, mm-hmm. and then our elders don't have resources that they need. And, like, historically, especially, like, within families of color, your elders are always around helping, taking care of the kids. Like, everyone's together in the house, but, like, it's this constant separation. And let's talk about the prison industrial complex, mm-hmm. and with like specifically with black men, like we're disrupting the family dynamic and then wondering why people are going without. Mm-hmm. And it's like, we are not, us black and brown people are not wondering, we know why, mm-hmm. you know? And so when people are like, it's your fault or it's this or it's that, it's like, no, don't point your finger at me. You know, if you have the privilege to be able to point a finger, like let's look back on what's going on with you, you know? Mm-hmm. And that is like, it is really scary. Like when I actually like panned out and was like, they have literally criminalized poverty. How did they do that? Mm-hmm. Like, that's awful. Mm-hmm. And then they say all these negative things about us, and it's our fault, or we did it to ourselves, or why can't we just, or da-da-da-da-da. And it's like, no. Like, this is what the government wants. We play down here while they make all the decisions up there. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, that is white supremacy. Mm-hmm. You know? That's literally what it is in a nutshell. Mm-hmm. In a big nutshell.
It's a quite large nut.
Yeah.
One of the things I find so fascinating about the way you've recreated the Free Fridge program here
yeah.
is the opportunity for collaboration. Mm-hmm. Like, you threw off, the plan is to dive more into this, but like the way you like, and then we did art on it, and I connected with businesses and restaurants and mm-hmm. all of these things, like the opportunity, you said very casually how you're popular because you make a lot of friends and you make these connections. But I would love to hear more specifically and intentionally how you like were able to tie those things back into this very specific program and be able to find a place for them. Like the way
yeah.
you were able to like connect artists to this, being like, actually you can decorate this fridge. I want you to have your image on here. I want you to make this yours. Where you connected with restaurants and businesses and just had them see how they could be involved.
Mm-hmm.
I want to hear more about that.
Yeah, that, so the art piece to it, which like again was something that I had seen in the other ones. And it's like, I think that it's such a wild thing to like see a refrigerator outside. Mm-hmm. So like, number one, it's gotta look like something. It can't just like be a refrigerator, because the first couple times we put them out, people were trying to like junk them. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no, it's a brand new fridge. Just open it up. And like, as many signs as we could put on them, it's sometimes it just didn't work, but none of them were ever junked or taken. But, mm-hmm. That was like the first thing. Is like, how do we invite people in, mm-hmm. and how do we let this be like, how do we get art on a thing that people might not think art would be on, mm-hmm. you know? And so, like, that was another one where it's, like, I'm doing reparations work, and now, like, I've done residency programs with Black and Brown artists, and I'm, like, okay, like, this is a different, like, canvas. Mm-hmm. And how do we bring your art, and how do we tell a story with your art to be able to bring it alive? So it's, like, you know, freedom to do what you want on the fridge, mm-hmm. and to be able to, like, really show just your artistic side, and like maybe introducing your art to people who have never heard of you or don't know you, mm-hmm. and how like Jade Warwick, one of my best friends, she did the giant mural downtown, which is a big Black girl with a big sunflower, mm-hmm. and it's like 60 feet. It's like one of the biggest murals in Albany.
Right.
And she painted two of the fridges, mm-hmm. and so actually three of the fridges. So it's like, oh wow, like that's Jade's art. Oh wow. Everything is connected. And so it's like this reminder that everything is connected, and it's not all separate.
Right.
And that like there is a way for us to be reminded that our community is here, because everything does feel like really isolated, mm-hmm. and it's not. Mm-hmm. And then as far as like the restaurants and farms go, just taking ownership, as the first time I ever reached out to anybody, they all were like, I wanted to do something, but I didn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. And so now I've provided an opportunity for them to do something. Mm-hmm. And that specifically was like huge. Mm-hmm. Because then I was having farmers come to the fridges, mm-hmm. and then people in the neighborhood were coming to the fridges when the farmers were dropping off. Mm-hmm. And now we're like taking that middle step out, and it's like literally from the farm to the fridge. Mm-hmm. And it's like as low intervention as possible, as close to like, again, from the ground as it can be. And how do we really like seal those gaps up, mm-hmm. Where we don't see fresh produce as much, mm-hmm. or we might go to the bodega or a smaller store in our communities, but that's it, you mm-hmm. know? And so how do we like really take out steps, mm-hmm. and how do we like get, it's like direct service. And then like, I don't know, all the neighborhoods we have fridges, like there are so many people from other countries, mm-hmm. and like who grew up on farms, who grew up eating fresh things from the earth every day, and they're like, we don't have this here. And it's not because they don't want it, but it's because it's concrete everywhere. Like, mm-hmm. and we, you know, normalizing, what are they called? Raised bed boxes, mm-hmm. and stuff. Like, mm-hmm. those things are really important and vital, and like, mm-hmm. we can do them more, mm-hmm. but it's like, there's not space, or there's not necessarily like education, or right. if there is the education, that you don't know how to build the thing, or mm-hmm. whatever it is. So, it's really been incredible, especially because there's so many farms in this area. Mm-hmm. It's been incredible to be able to, like, bridge that gap.
Yeah. And really have them see that there's something they can do in Albany specifically, mm-hmm. that has, like, a direct connection.
Like, and, yeah, and it's, like, it's taking even me out of it. I'm, like, I provided the thing, and I'm, like, you guys talk, you know? Like,
you can just pull yourself away from it.
Exactly. Like, I'm just, like, I'm going to step back. And, like, so we really encourage people to, like, literally pick it up and go bring it to the fridges, because like number one, so that we can like have less people having to like do things all the time, mm-hmm. but also just like, again, reestablishing those connections.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So as you were setting this up initially as a lead person and sort of putting this together, how were you fundraising for this at all, or how has the fundraising for this shifted during the time that you've been involved?
It's honestly always been the same. I've done crowdfunding, okay. and we just recently got a grant in, and like we still don't have it yet, mm-hmm. so it's all been crowdfunding,
okay.
And donations from people, and mm-hmm. that's like really it. Like, great. People have like gifted us money, mm-hmm. and like especially with like news articles come out and stuff, like people gift us stuff, but mm-hmm. other than that, like that's all it is.
Okay.
So
that from like the beginning of the pandemic, where we had no idea what was going on, everything was scary, up until now when it's still scary, but like it's slightly more stable in terms of that. People are just seeing the work that's being done and finding the website and donating directly to it.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And so when grants are happening, are you guys working on that?
I have someone who, Erin Donahue, who like, she is a saint. She works at the South End Children's Cafe, and Tracy Kilar and Erin have been like so pivotal in helping me. Mm-hmm. Like last winter I called Tracy, and she's been doing the South End Children's Cafe for I think 8 to 10 years. Mm-hmm. And I called her like kind of freaking out, like, what am I doing? Mm-hmm. And she was like, don't worry, we got you. Mm-hmm. And like that to me, like I'm like trying not to cry right now, like mm-hmm. that was so huge for me, because mm-hmm. here I am feeling again isolated. I'm like, okay, I've done this thing, I'm doing this thing, mm-hmm. and I'm like, what do I do next? Mm-hmm. And she was like, we got you. And then Erin started working with me, and Erin's been like just so incredible, and I just like I owe a lot to her, because she's like really helped us take it to the next step. Something I'm like, I worked at a nonprofit, never learned grant writing, mm-hmm. and so like I don't really understand grants. I understand that they're complicated sometimes, mm-hmm. and I understand that they are hard, and it's a skill I would like to learn. Mm-hmm. But I think we're in a shift for grants right now, like shifting in like what is necessary. And so with like the grant that we just received, like they just want to be a part of us as like a seed. Mm-hmm. They don't want it to be like, well, you need to show us before you get the end result. And it's like, no, like, it's like one of those things where, they just like, they see what we can do. They see what we've done, and they want us to keep going and be able to have the support and backing. And mm-hmm. so like with that, like those relationships like have been incredible, and they will continue to be incredible. But like Erin really helped that for me.
That's actually a good portion to jump off of, because like we've talked a lot about the various networks that you've created that help with the free food, but thinking about like the nonprofit and advocacy landscape that mm-hmm. exists in the Capital Region and in Albany, like being able to like see elders and peers at different levels and be able to make connections with them seems so crucial, being able to like continue to do the work. And so I would love to give you the opportunity to like truly just shout out people who have like made those connections for you and the work that they're doing, so we can see the systems that exist that are able to further keep you and keep this project going.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, South End Children's Cafe, mm-hmm. Honest Wait Food Co-op, they've leveraged a lot of like, not even just monetarily, but just like food. Mm-hmm. And they've like rewritten a lot of the way that they do their work based on me, mm-hmm. and like my project. And mm-hmm. so that has been really pivotal. United Way, they've been really great. And I think the United Way here has really taken a lot of strides beyond what it was 4 or 5 years ago, mm-hmm. to be able to like support BIPOC grassroots organizations. Mm-hmm. And so like, obviously people aren't perfect, but they really have done a lot. And honestly, like, I gotta shout out just, like, everybody that has ever donated, whether it be $1 or $2 or $100 or $1,000, like, the community, like, when I say the community, like, shows up, like, mm-hmm. they really do show up, mm-hmm. And, like, even things just like this that we're doing, mm-hmm. like, this helps, and, like, newspaper articles, even if I don't like the Times, like, newspaper articles and all that, like, that really amplifies what we're doing. And so it's really just like thanking the community. And when I say the community, I literally mean, it's not like the community is great. It's like, no, this community is like out of control. And I just hope that everybody who's working with me continues to work with us and like works with other places and sees what they're doing. And that like, it really does take a whole city mm-hmm. to do the work.
Mm-hmm. And so when we think about the many ways in which the community sees you and are affected, we have to then go immediately to the fact that you were on the cover of Time magazine.
Yeah.
And what was that process like, and how you've seen that? How what was that like?
Yeah, that was really crazy. So I quit my job, like I said earlier, March 2020, and literally a year later, I was on the cover of Time magazine.
Yeah.
So that was nuts. And they just found me. They like were looking up people in the pandemic, specifically women, although I identify as a woman, like at that time that was what like how I identified. So mm-hmm. they were looking up women in the pandemic, and I somehow got on their radar. Mm-hmm. And then like they reached out to me, and I remember I was driving to the co-op actually. Mm-hmm. And I shouldn't have been looking at my phone, but I was looking at my phone, and I got this like email, and it was like from so-and-so at time.com. And I'm like, I've gotten bots messaging me and stuff. So I was like, okay, this is a bot. This isn't a real person. Mm-hmm. And then I like looked at it again and I was like, oh my God. Uh-huh. Time Magazine just reached out to me and I like, I was like, I just come and a few days before, maybe a week before, I had done a, in the fall of 2020, I had done a interview with BuzzFeed. Mm-hmm. And so I figured that they found me because of that. Mm-hmm. And that's not what happened. They just like organically found me.
Wow.
So they, and they had not even seen the art, they had not even seen the video. And I was like, wow, that's really wild. So yeah. Anyway, like the next week they sent out a reporter from Time Magazine mm-hmm. who just came, I picked her up from the train station and then she rode around with me all day. She even came to my house and did work. Mm-hmm. And like, I took her on like a field tour, basically like location scouting mm-hmm. and farming, like the farms we work with that were like close proximity. And mm-hmm. it was just like a really wild thing. Mm-hmm. And then they sent a photographer out who like it photographs like Solange and like big artists. I was like, wild. They sent her from Brooklyn up here. And I like took her on the same thing. We like went out, we like got one. It was just like a really wild experience.
Yeah.
And like, I just showed her. And like, even when she was riding with me, she was like, wow, it's like a really stark difference from neighborhood to neighborhood.
Yeah.
And we went to Troy and we went to Albany. So it was just like really a wild thing to like, for someone who's like not from here mm-hmm. to really like, just be like, yeah, it's obviously like, this is wild. Like yeah. the differences in neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And so like, yeah, that just really like propelled us into a direction that I didn't think it would. And so we got a lot of like a lot of good press and people have opinions and whether they're negative or positive and any, either way, like they were able to like really, help up the ante on what we could provide for people.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get paid for that. Like that, you know, I don't, people thought I got paid to do that or something. And,
right.
or that like someone put my name in, like people thought it was like the city of Albany that got me on. And I was like, this is all organic. This was like not,
right.
this had nothing to do with anybody
yeah.
except for us in the project,
yeah.
you know, like that's it. And so not that I need that like credit or anything, but people just really thought it was some sort of like inside job for
right.
a second.
Right.
I was like, it's not. And they were with me. They wrote down every word I said and
mm-hmm.
like, it was a 4-page spread
mm-hmm.
and it was the anchor article within like this larger story.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of 4 covers. So like, it was like a double issue and
mm-hmm.
it went everywhere. People were sending them to me from everywhere,
wild.
Like pictures of them. And yeah, it was really wild.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, and that was 2021.
Yes. Which, yeah, it's coming up on 2 years now.
It's coming up on 2 years. So it's easy to just look back and be like, and then it just sort of exploded because
yeah.
like, that's so much additional press, like it's
right.
way more national than you had previously been in that kind of space. But like, are there any like definitive changes that you can think like, oh no, Time Magazine actually allowed for these things to happen?
I think like it allowed other people to recognize that they could also do what I do,
mm-hmm.
which is what we want.
Yeah.
Which is like, they saw me as just like a person.
Yeah.
And I am just a person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that was like a ripple effect because a lot of like people have been like, oh, we started the same project where we live because of you or whatever. And I'm like, cool. I started because of these other people, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm like, it's like, I think the biggest thing was the ripple effect that it had
mm-hmm.
for people to like have the agency and audacity that I have and to like just go out and do it.
Sure.
Because once I have something in my brain, I'm like, I'm doing that.
Yeah.
That's it. So I think that specifically is the real answer.
Fantastic. That's a great answer. So I was going to shift to the creation of clothes.
Yes.
Because one of it's a all the hard work that some people that people do in advocacy and in nonprofit work, it's very intentional, I think, for a lot of us to be like, when this is something that I do that is just for me.
Yes. Yes.
And that's what it feels like when I see you promoting the stuff on social media. That
yeah.
that is an art form that you have really adopted and pour your whole self into. So I want to just focus on that for a bit. How did you get started in that? What would you say was your start?
Honestly, I got a sewing machine last year for Christmas.
Sure.
And I had started like, I started getting into thrifting because honestly, another thing that was like thrifting always felt bad to me because I didn't have money.
Mm.
So I was like, I don't want to thrift because I don't want to like be associated with that as if it was like a bad thing. Now I'm like, I cannot believe that I just started doing this, because I'm like, I find some really cool stuff.
Yeah.
But that's kind of how it started, was like, I was like, oh, like, I want to, like, I need, like, a winter activity. Winters are really depressing here, and, or they can be depressing, and, like, I, especially, like, in the pandemic, these past two winters have been really hard. So it was one of those things where I wanted to do something that, like, kind of occupied my time, and that was sort of completely separate from everything I was doing, like you had said. And so I started thrifting, and then I started, like, I avoided it as long as I could, but I started going on TikTok, and I started seeing all these people thrifting and, like, upcycling their clothes. And I thought that was really cool, and so I'd ask for a sewing machine for Christmas, and so, like, it was, like, the marriage of the two things, like, thrifting, upcycling, and then now my sewing machine. And then I started realizing, like, that there, like, there's always been this, like, huge issue with, like, bodies and clothing in the stores. And I wanted people, like, everything I've ever done, I just want people to be able to have access, right? And so for me, it was like, well, how can I make clothing more accessible? And, like, especially when I came out as non-binary, I wanted to, like, sort of step away from, like, classically what they make women, or, like, what they, what the society says women should dress like. And so it was, like, really, like, unlearning a lot of that, and then, like, you know, clothes for bodies, and, like, how can we just make clothes for bodies and not worry about, like, all these layers and how they make us feel bad, and, like, what can I do to help people feel good in this way? And so I started sewing, teaching myself how to sew again, upcycling a little bit, and then I started seeing people do vintage blankets and make them into stuff. And so that's what I started doing. And I remember the first one I ever did took me like 3 days to do. I just, like, didn't understand how to do it. And I was, like, teaching myself as I went. And now, like, I'm definitely a lot faster at it. But then I started working into, like, vintage blankets. And I'm really reminded of my grandma and, like, her, like, my grandma and my great grandma. And they had all these Afghans and blankets all around the house. And I, like, so I see them, and it reminds me of that. Like, I've always inspired by that. My grandma had, like, such a huge impact on my life, but she died when I was 15. So, like, really at a huge turning point for me as a kid, and with, like, stuff with my mom, and my dad had moved away, and so it was really hard. But I, she really, like, has always been in my brain, and is always sort of, like, my, like, guide. And I just, like, I don't know, she was the one that turned me on to sewing as a kid, but then I, like, stepped away from it. She had got me, like, a little kid sewing machine, and it broke or something, but sewing always reminded me of her, and so then I was able to, like, as an adult, get into it, and I was like, oh, this will be, like, a fun hobby thing to do, and so then I just, like, I just started doing it, and I became, like, really obsessed with doing it, and, like, thinking of all the different ways, and, like, all the different bodies, and, like, and then I started doing markets, and so it sort of, like, snowballed, like, everything I do sort of, like, snowballs, and it becomes, like, big. And so it was a little hobby, but now it's a business. And, like, I'm really proud of that. And really happy, because it is so separate from what I do, but, like, it's not. You know, it's all, like, this, like, child version of myself that I'm protecting and, like, rewriting the narrative of, like, what it is to be us. And I always said when I was a kid that I just want people to feel more comfortable in their bodies and with themselves. And I feel like that is what I put out in all the work I do, whether it's being a yoga teacher or a doula or the fridge person or making clothing. Like, I just want people to have, like, agency. I want people to feel that they have agency, and I'm not giving it to them. It's like reminding them of their own power. And whether it seems silly that it's a piece of food or a sweater or whatever it is, I feel like that's really, like, what I've been called to do. And so I get broached with the question, like, What did you think you were going to do when you grow up? And I'm like, honestly, what I'm doing. You know, whether I knew that it was going to be what I'm doing, it's like the energy behind it and the force driving it is what I wanted as a kid.
Yeah. So I feel like we've reached sort of like a toward of an end here.
Yeah.
But are there any, is there anything you would have wanted that we didn't touch on yet?
Because
I've got some reflection question at the end.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to give you the opportunity before that.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think that was, I talk a lot, so.
No, this has been good. This has been good. So, but as the public historian of the Albany African American History Project, this is going into our collection, going into the for the Institute in terms of 20th and 21st century Black history. And as someone who's clearly very aware of the many systems and the histories, and learning a lot more further more about the systems that impacted all the systems that we're still within, what do you think about the way you learned about Black history in Albany as a kid here?
I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's it.
Yeah.
Like, I, again, like, walking into museums,
mm-hmm.
like, you're not really seeing yourself reflected
mm-hmm.
as a Black child.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, like, you don't really know how much that affects you,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I think that art, when I go downtown and I go to the Capitol and there's a white man on a horse
mm-hmm.
in front of the state Capitol building,
mm-hmm.
like, what does that say?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I don't ever, and a lot of the history is written incorrectly,
mm-hmm.
and there are not mentions of anything that have to do with our history
mm-hmm.
here, and, like, the slavery and the genocides that have happened on the land that we're on, specifically as, like, one of the first colonies and one of the first places that people landed
mm-hmm.
in, like, the Northeast and, like, New England area. Like, none of that is really reflected. It's
mm-hmm.
only the colonizers who are reflected
mm-hmm.
and depicted.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I read a book and then I see that, it's like, I'm not a part of this history, but I'm like, we are the history,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that is missing,
mm-hmm.
like, that huge piece. And when I go into a museum that has, like, artifacts from other places, and, you know, it's like, a lot of those artifacts were stolen
mm-hmm.
and they were then donated or whatever. It's like, can we undo that? Can we, like, really, like, okay, you have them in the museum, but can we tell a story about why it's problematic?
Mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
or, like, I think Robert E. Lee was at the is it Robert E. Lee? There was someone who is this huge statue outside of the Museum of American History or Natural History in New York.
I think that was Teddy Roosevelt.
Was it Teddy Roosevelt?
I could be wrong. Don't ignore us if we're wrong.
Yes. Whoever it is, it doesn't matter. It's a white man on a horse.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, like, outside of this museum with all of this indigenous stuff inside.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, why is this colonizer depicted outside? Like, why is that the, like, why is it still there? And I think they actually just recently took it down.
I think it was very recent.
So whoever the white man was, they took him down. And that's incredible, right? But it's, like, just a start. And it's, like,
yeah.
we can't just be taking down things. We need to be, like, writing on why it's bad. And there actually is a whole exhibit in there about why that
mm-hmm.
Statue is bad, which mm-hmm. I'm like, wow, that's great.
Yeah.
But it's, like, that's not typically what it's like. We
mm-hmm.
don't need to be more memorializing these people as if they did something good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they did something good for them at that time, but
mm-hmm.
not for anybody else, the people who are on this land
mm-hmm.
and the people who they brought over here to build it,
mm-hmm.
you know?
So as someone who's aware of these systems and is very conscious of the fact that you didn't learn Black history at the time as a kid, what would you say your hopes could be for a project like mine? Let's put it all on the record.
Like a project like...
Like what the one I'm doing right now.
What's sorry, repeat the question one more time.
So thinking back on how you did not learn Black history
yes.
as a child, and knowing that I am actively trying to collect and interpret Black history in the 20th and 21st century here at the Institute,
okay,
but focused
it.
On the city of Albany, what would your hopes be for a project like that?
My hopes would be that that the story doesn't get taken
mm-hmm.
and used as a tokenized thing,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, it's like, if you're doing it,
mm-hmm.
like, everyone should be doing it,
mm-hmm.
you know? Like, because I feel like what happens is that they always want to fit, and they always want a quota to be,
mm-hmm.
we've checked the box off,
mm-hmm.
we've marked this, okay, we've done that.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be, everything needs to have this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, everyone should be doing this. There should be oral histories, there should be written, there should be movies and photographs and, like, of the actual current history that we're creating.
Mm-hmm.
And so I hope that, my hope is that more of it happens
mm-hmm.
and that it's not reliant on the only Black employee
mm-hmm.
of any place.
There's three of us, but yes.
Well,
yeah,
I mean,
it's
that's
even still.
But
still.
That is huge to
mm-hmm.
say that there are three.
Mm-hmm.
But because you have to be able to just say that. Like,
yeah.
I'm not, no one's counting how many white staff.
That's true.
Or, you know, like, no one's, because it's just assumed that that's
no,
going to be
it's,
who's
it's,
here.
It's an important part of the conversation.
Right.
Absolutely. No, I think that makes a ton of sense. I want to thank you again for your time. You were
thank
fantastic
you.
On this. I'm gonna stop.